Welcome to the Angus Table, the podcast from Angus Australia. I'm Scott Wright, the CEO at Angus Australia. Each episode will bring conversations with breeders, industry leaders, innovators, insights, stories and ideas that matter and hopefully add value to your Angus operation. Whether it's genetics, markets, pasture management, marketing experts or people shaping the breed, this is where the Angus community pulls up a chair at the Angus Table. Thanks for joining us. Welcome to the Angus Table today. Very special guest, Will Evans from Cattle Australia. So, Will, thanks for making time for the Angus community today.
No, thanks for having me on, mate. I really appreciate the opportunity. No,
it's good. You're the CEO of Cattle Australia, which is our peak industry body. So great to maybe explore a little bit about that this morning, Will. But I guess how I got to know you is a couple of NTCA conferences. And must say, I was at the NTCA conference when they gave you a farewell, Will, and it was quite touching, to be honest. It was one of the best send-offs I've seen.
I think, the NTCA in a lot of ways is a real embodiment of a lot of the things that we love about our industry. And it's one of those organisations that, you know, has a really special place in Australian agriculture, a really special place in my heart. It's you're very much part of the community when you're in that role, and you're very much someone who's relied upon and someone who is foundational to a lot of what happens in the north. And it's a privilege to be in those roles. You know, the way I always talked about it was, you're not really the CEO of the NTCA, you're kind of the custodian of it. And your job is to make sure that it's a bit better. You leave it a bit better than when you got it, and you're handing it off in the best shape possible. You don't really run the NTCA. It's its own sort of living entity, and your job is to keep it healthy and keep it functioning and really try to safeguard it for the next generation. And so I think those sorts of roles in particular, with those long-standing organisations around the country, and there's other organisations like it, don't get me wrong, but from my experience, it's a real privilege to be in those sorts of positions, and it comes with a huge responsibility. So I'm very happy with my years there, and I'm really happy to have left it in the very capable hands that it's in now.
What an interesting organisation. Of all the conferences I've been fortunate to get to, probably the most unique, I would say, Will.
It's definitely got its own characteristics and quirks about it. Look, I think it's one of those things. The territory by sort of a quirk of fate in some ways, or legacy of legislation, you know, the reality is the agricultural land in the territory is substantially cattle land, and the tenure is pastoral lease in perpetuity, generally speaking. So it's a region where it may not be the biggest cattle producer in Australia, or it may not be the most productive country in Australia, but its fate and its identity is indelibly tied to cattle production. And even for those who would like to do something else with that country, it's very difficult just from a legal perspective. And I think that kind of flows through. You know, everyone has this connection with the cattle industry in the territory. You don't have to go far through Darwin or through Katherine or through Alice Springs, and you know, you run into people they might be a school teacher, or they might be an electrician, or they might be a plumber, but they've all spent time on a station at some point in their lives, or been to school with guys who worked on stations. And so it's one of those places where the identity of the cattle industry is still really strong.
Yeah, so it's an amazing part of the country. We, as Angus Australia, have a few members around Alice Springs, so I've been fortunate to get to know some of those guys. And you've got quite a split, don't you? Not that you're in the territory now, but there's quite a split, isn't there, production systems of, you know, are they different types of groups of people to work with?
Yeah, I mean, the overwhelming weight of numbers in the territory, I think there's a perception that it's all sort of corporate ag now, but the reality is it's still, the weight of numbers is still very much family, like the Australian cattle industry. And even for the guys who are corporates, you know, like generally speaking, the managers are guys who've been there a long time. They're part of the community and they're part of the fabric of the place. But, you know, the territory splits into very, very generally kind of three production regions. It's that far top end coastal strip of really struck ground cattle that go on boats to Indonesia and Vietnam. And then you come further down, you start seeing some more crossbred cattle, certainly on the Barkly, you start seeing, you know, far more, I guess, what you'd expect to see in Queensland kind of cattle. And then as you get further south into the Alice and the desert regions, you really see that really strong Angus representation. You see a lot of the sort of more southern brutes. And I think for years, I think everyone's caught on now, but for years, Alice was sort of a bit of a secret of the cattle, or a best kept secret of the cattle industry. It's incredible country to produce livestock on. I think the systems that it births and the businesses that it births in that region, you know, if you're going to survive, you've really got to understand your ecosystem, and you've really got to have a really close connection with your country. It's the sort of place where, you know, a mistake you make for a month this year could cost you 6 months next year, sort of thing. It's very unforgiving. So the guys who produce there and the guys who produce great Angus cattle there seriously know what they're doing and very much committed to you know, what I'd say is really high-level beef production.
One of the things that sticks out for me in that environment is the flavour of the beef. And they can finish cattle just on such a low rainfall on natural pastures. If I had to nominate some of the best steaks I've ever had in my life, it's off that country, quite incredible.
No, it is. It definitely is. And I think it's one of those places that we've learned how to produce cattle in a very native system. You know, there's obviously buckle grass has been a huge addition to that environment. But, you know, the way that we built our systems in those sorts of places is, you know, when you take all the tools out of the tool chest that we would traditionally sort of use and you're left with the natural ecosystem, how do you build a expansive cattle operation in those areas? So for me, it's a very Australian production system. It's very much built around what's available in the natural environment. And I think that makes it a really interesting sort of, it makes the product and the produce that comes out of that region really interesting.
Mm. Now, Will, you had a great tenure at the NTCA. You've moved to Cattle Australia. What's your background? Maybe you could just give the listeners a bit of a feel for where you commenced your career and what's been your journey.
I'm one of those people, and there's a handful of them in the industry. I've always been a bit of an agricultural policy nerd, I'd say. I wrote my grade 9 social sciences essay, or you know, task I had to do that term, on the breakdown of the AWB wheat board and the effects that would have on the Australian wheat industry. So I think I've always been destined to end up in a place like this without really realising it. But to me, I'm a Queenslander by birth, and when I came out of uni, I actually started working for what was then the Cattle Council of Australia. So that was sort of my first professional gig in ag, and that's more than 10 years ago now. And I really got a crash course exposure into what cattle policy looks like at a federal level and how that interrelates with federal policy making, federal legislation. And then how that relates into the other sectors of Australian agriculture. So for me, it was a gift to be in that role straight out of uni. And then, you know, I think that for those who interacted with Cattle Council at that time, it was an organisation that had a lot of strengths, but it had a lot of challenges as well. And I think, you know, but for me, it was the perfect place to start my career. And I left Canberra predominantly due to the fact that I just couldn't do any more winters down there. And I was given the opportunity to go be the CEO for the Northern Territory Livestock Exporters Association, who at the time was the chair was David Warren, and that was my introduction to the territory. And I was very lucky to meet a lot of wonderful people in that role and get a lot of exposure to, you know, the unique aspects of the north, and get a lot of exposure around live export in Southeast Asia, which has really helped me a lot with, you know, the fundamentals of that business and the fundamentals of our trading relationships. And I think one of the great things in live export that you get a lot of exposure to is how much other countries really rely on what we do here and really rely on us to feed them and to feed their families. And live export, for a variety of different reasons, is one of those things where it's very tangible. You really see it when you go to Indonesia and you go to the feedlots and you know, in some of these feedlots, there might be 400 or 500 people from the local community working in the feedlot. And, you know, a bit like regional Australia in some ways, if you take that feedlot out of those regions, there really isn't a lot of other employment. So the way in which our system feeds into their system and the way in which it supports regional communities in a really big way is something I think we probably undervalue and underappreciate as a country, and something that I saw firsthand. So I think live export really helps. I had a good technical knowledge around how policy works, but live export was one of those things that taught me this is what it looks like on the ground. This is the practical realities. I mean, live export's got to be one of the most heavily regulated industries in Australia. So that practical experience of this is what the implementation of these rules looks like, and this is what the implementation of policy on the day-to-day basis looks like, was something that gave me probably the other side of the coin that I needed. I understood the theory behind it, and then moving to the territory, I was sort of blessed to get that opportunity to see this is what it looks like from a practical perspective, and meet some really amazing people. And then after a fair few years there, and I went through COVID at the live exporters, which was one of the more challenging things I think I've ever done. I was lucky enough to move over to the NTCA, which was a great opportunity.
And well, what did you study before you?
I kind of had a bit of a winding path through uni. When I first started uni, I studied political science and international relations. Kind of halfway through that, I realized, oh God, after I finish this degree, I really need to get a job. And, you know, the joke about Bachelor of Arts students is that, you know, the only thing you need to learn is, do you want fries with that? So I thought, oh geez, that's probably true. I better branch out a little bit. So I changed into law, and I studied law for a few years. And I guess enjoyed it to a point, but found I started working during my degree, and it wasn't something for me that was going to fit. And I just thought, oh, look, I couldn't see myself being a solicitor in the future. So I jumped over. I went working for a few years, especially like in the gas in Queensland at the time. You didn't need a lot of qualifications to be quite highly paid. And so I went out and did that for a little while, then found myself in the country and being reminded that despite, you know, a lifetime or a childhood of saying, oh, I'm never going to work in agriculture because that's what my dad did, I was reminded that I do actually deeply love it. And I deeply love being out in the bush. And then I went back to Gatton and I ended up studying agribusiness at Gatton. So a bit of a winding road to get me to where I got to. But you know, with the benefit of hindsight, I look back now and go, like a lot of those things I picked up, a lot of those skills I learned are things that have stood me in really good stead for today. So yeah, at the time, I think it probably wasn't as well planned as it could have been, but I'm fortunate for the experiences and the things that I've learned during that time.
And you just a gold nugget in there somewhere, Will. I'm a Gatton graduate, so great to find another one. They're always good to find. So I did real management a long time ago. So yeah, no. It's actually quite a good story.
And I heard the Black Pigs had a win for the first time in a long time last year, so I'm pretty excited about that, to be honest. I missed the final too, which I was really disappointed about. But no, my dad was a Gatton boy as well. And yeah, it's one of those great, it's one of the great institutions, I think, certainly in Northern Ag or in Queensland Ag. And yeah, no, it's a great university to study at.
Excellent. And now you're back in Toowoomba, you can see it a bit more regularly.
That's right. I can go to the games a bit more. I'm definitely not going to be going to any of the games against Gundawindi because I still have the scars from getting beat 100 points by them. But it's a great university.
That's great. Well, so you've made the move then to Cattle Australia about 12 months ago. Is that right?
About just over six months ago, yeah.
6 months, yep. Okay. Do you want to give us a lot of our listeners will be quite familiar with Cattle Australia, but sometimes these bodies can be confusing in terms of what they do, what's the role. Do you want to give us a snapshot of Cattle Australia, Will, for the membership?
Yeah, I'm more than happy to. So I think the thing that's unique about Cattle Australia, so Cattle Australia has a dual function, essentially. Its initial function, when it was established, you know, many, many years ago before the 80s, was around being that peak voice for specifically for cattle producers, you know, and that was, it was very much focused on a lobbying role specifically with the government. And I think that people can often get confused about, you know, why do we need a cattle organisation when we've got the National Farmers Federation, when we've got all of these other groups. But one of the things about the peak commodity groups that is different from, say, the National Farmers Federation is they really deal on a lot of the specific technical detail around the industry. But the National Farmers Federation has an incredible history around things like workforce relations, taxation, all of those catch-all big policy areas that impact all farmers across Australia. But what the peg commodity groups were established really to do was to have that technical expertise specifically around their industries and in the intricacies of trade relationships and you know all of the things that flow out of that. That was what the peak commodity groups were established for. Then we moved forward and we picked up an additional role in the 90s when there was a huge structural reform around how the how this would the I guess the ecosystem around the beef industry operated. And we became what's called a prescribed industry body. So under the Australian Meat and Livestock Industries Act, Cattle Australia or Cattle Council then, but Cattle Australia today is tasked specifically, or part of our task specifically, is oversighting and having strategic input into the allocation of our levies. There's obviously three recipients of the levy being MLA, AHA, and NRS. And we work very closely with those three organisations around how levies are allocated, what they're going towards, what that strategic intent behind the industry is, and really trying to make sure that, you know, for the hundreds of millions of dollars that we spend every year in this space, that we're making sure that we're working towards a strategic imperative that rewards on the ground producers. So for producers who have challenges or concerns in those areas, Cattle Australia is the body to go to and have a discussion with.
And it put you quite some interesting conversations at times, Will, I imagine.
One of the amazing things about Cattle Australia is the rooms that you find yourself in. It's really where the intersection between how levies are allocated, how that influences trading relationships, how that influences research and development on the ground. That then flows through federal policy setting into state policy setting. And obviously varies across the country. So it's quite a complex role, and there's a lot of players in this space, I guess. But one of the things is specifically, I guess, our charge and our challenge is to make sure that the decisions that government's making and the decisions that industry's making in terms of investment have that farm gate return. We've really, in the last 6 months or 12 months, really realigned that focus on we need to be talking about producer profitability. There's a lot of things that have happened in the last 5 or 6 years that I think governments in some ways have shifted more to market expectations or consumer expectations. And we've taken our eye off the ball. It was about what can producers do for consumers as opposed to what can the country or what can the, I guess, the industry do to help producers be more profitable. So we've very much realigned that now. And a focus for us and a focus for MLA and a focus that we're communicating through to government is all of these additional requirements that we're expecting of producers are underpinned by one fundamental and one fundamental alone, and that's their profitability. If producers aren't making money, they can't be investing in sustainability initiatives or any of these additional things that are kind of becoming more commonplace within the industry. Profitability is the thing that underpins all of these desires and aspirations that our supply chain has for us.
We've noticed the trend with government, I guess, more widely, will to in some governments, not all, to walk away from investments in production and productivity and profitability, and particularly in New South Wales, we've seen that more recently. Do you see that generally across the country with state and federal? Is that a trend you're trying to counter?
Yeah, it definitely is. I think it's reflected globally as well. When I was a kid, you know, you couldn't turn on a TV without seeing a World Vision ad about, you know, people suffering from famines and really global food shortages was the sort of the common theme there. The world in Australia has become very good at producing food, and Australia in particular has been a global leader in this. We're a 70% export business, so we don't just feed the Australian population many, many times over. We also feed a large number of other countries as well. What I think we've seen is a shift from we need to feed people to, well, how are we feeding them and what's the product that we're feeding them with? And the sort of flow on from that around the conditionality that people expect around those things. And Australia was a leader in this space, you know, coming out of the you know, certainly in the 90s and in the 80s, coming out of some really big global concerns around beef safety. You know, we're talking about, you know, FMD outbreaks, BSE outbreaks globally. I think there was a real drive to ensure that if we're going to be selling beef globally or if people are going to continue to consume it at the levels that we'd like them to, then the safety of the product was critical. And Australia really led the way with the NIS systems, the LPA, the MP, and those, and really embedding integrity systems in what we do. And I know for a lot of people listening to this, that the three acronyms I've just used can be the bane of their existence. That they can be really frustrating to engage with. But from a trading perspective and from a high level industry perspective, they're really the things that have underpinned so much of our success. You know, you go back to 2009 or 2010, and we have one free trade agreement with the US. You know, today we've got more than 10 free trade agreements. Beef's preferenced in a large number of global markets. Australia is well renowned for clean green beef, and you know, that's sort of been the slogan for a long time. But part of the way that we've got there is by being ahead of the world in what we're able to do with our integrity systems and the way in which we're able to guarantee our supply chains. And so for us, it's, you know, it can be very frustrating for a producer on the ground. But some of those things that we do have really underpinned the prosperity that we've been able to achieve.
Well, from a practical engagement point of view, how does Cattle Australia sit with MLA? A lot of our members are obviously very interested in the MLA programs they operate. So in a governance structure, how does that work?
Yeah, so the starting point and probably the key transition, or the key element that was changed during the transition from Cattle Council to Cattle Australia, is the foundations of what we do is we have 15 regions around the country which are modelled on the basically the regional consultative functions that MLA and ABARES recognises. So we have 15 different people who are directly elected by those regions. They come together a few times a year and provide us with strategic advice on where they see the challenges and where they see things that need to be improved within the operations of the industry and the structures that we sit in. We then take those and really we will build our operations over the next 12 months around those things. And then what we do is they become the priorities for all of our engagement. So from a practical perspective, once we've got those priorities and we've got a meeting coming up to do that for the next financial year, what we then do is communicate that to MLA, communicate that through to AHA, NRS and the federal government. And we say, look, this is what the regions of Australia's beef producers are saying. This is the challenges that they're facing. Some of those challenges fit into, you know, the areas that we have control over. Some of those challenges fall out of that. But what we've got with MLA, certainly at the moment with the leadership that MLA has currently, is a really strong receptiveness to those things. They're very keen on hearing from producers regionally around what are the challenges that we're facing. And going back to what you're talking about with R&D, you know, there's no denying that industry in so many ways is now being looked at as, if not the only funder, then certainly the largest funder of research in the country. Like, I think historically there was far more global focus on food production, and that flowed through federal and state governments. And what we've seen in the last 30 years is really a withdrawal from that. But for us, it remains, you know, a critical part of our prosperity. And certainly for Angus producers, you know, the research that you guys have done over the years has been critical to the prosperity of the breed and the way that it's gone. Research and development is critically important, and it is facing a lot of challenges. So for us, in the context of what we do, making sure that we're allocating research really effectively to get the best bang for buck is part of the questions that we ask the regions. It's part of the things that we look for each year. As the part of the things that we feed into the MLA systems. So research, development, marketing, extension, you know, MLA really runs the table around a lot of those things nationally in terms of funding and how that's allocated. And our job is to make sure that funding aligns with what people are expecting.
Okay, no, that's great. Your membership base, Will, how does that, do you want to just outline how you achieve the membership base?
Yeah, so we have sort of two streams. So obviously the SFOs or the state farming organisations remain members of Cattle Australia as well. So we have membership of those institutions. We also have obviously membership of breed societies, membership of, I guess, more institutional beef industry kind of established bodies. But then the primary pathway for us in terms of what we're focusing on is direct membership, where people can just sign up directly to be a member of Cattle Australia. One of the quirks of the way the legislation is structured, and one of the challenges for us from an operational perspective is that we're required to represent the grass-fed beef industry, whether you're a member of us or not. So the reality on a day-to-day basis for us is we very much listen to the views of anybody. If you're a grass-fed levy payer in this country, we are very interested in what you have to say. The reality for us is our role and our function is to represent everybody. So it is a challenge for us. We provide direct value or different value sort of offerings to them if you're a grass-fed levy payer. But I think the key message from my perspective is we would love everyone to be a member, but the reality for our role and our function is if you've got a challenge in this space, then we want to hear from you, whether you're or not.
Yeah. But obviously you encourage producers to be direct members of Cattle Australia where they're able to.
Some of the simplest reasons behind that are we work really hard on making sure that, especially on sort of some of the big ticket issues that can fly under the media radar in particular, that our members know about those and are fully up to date. Like last week, we had a webinar with Dr. Beth Cookson, who's Australia's Chief Veterinary Officer. And what we're looking at in that space and what Beth's been absolutely incredible with her engagement with the industry on is, the LSD is a disease that obviously has spread pretty rapidly around the globe in the last 30 or 40 years. It's becoming a production challenge pretty well everywhere except Australia. And it's right on our doorstep in Indonesia. But one of the opportunities for us is that we can learn in real time what's happening and how other governments, especially in Western nations, are responding to their outbreaks. And we can take those lessons and put them into our systems and say, well, you know, France has had this outbreak or Spain has had this outbreak and this is how their response has worked. It's been effective or it hasn't been effective. How can we take those lessons and make sure that we're better prepared? So one of the things about being a member of Cattle Australia is we want to give people as many opportunities as possible to engage on things that are very, very important to the beef industry, but may not be the things that you're going to read in the Australian or the Fin Review every morning. And we want to make sure that as a member of Cattle Australia, you're really up to speed and given those opportunities to engage on some of those big issues that are beef-specific issues.
Yeah, okay. From a practical point of view, for example, MLA, they had their strategic plan rolled out last year. Do you have a bit of direct input into that?
Yeah, we do. So we're required to consult closely on that. And really, I think the things that we really look to in the strategic plan last year and worked really collaboratively with MLA on was that refocus on farm profitability is one of the big ones. The other one, which I think people will see, which really came from our consultation with the industry and something that we think is a huge gap in the landscape at the moment is research around methane and research around the cyclical nature of methane and research around we've got an obsession in this country at a federal level, especially at a regulatory level, around emissions from activities. But cattle producers in so many ways, and really specifically cattle producers, you need to take a landscape level look at that. So yes, we have activities that generate emissions, but business decisions that we make on a daily basis to improve the conditions of the land in which we operate, and you know, all of your members will have systems in place on their businesses that do this, they sequester carbon and they sequester things like methane. And so for us, we've long had this challenge at a federal level around trying to communicate the fact that just measuring an output only isn't really considering the full operations of a business. And obviously, I think everyone globally is seeing increased regulation around these things. And what we've seen in Europe is regulatory steps taken against cattle producers and regulatory steps taken against dairy industry in particular around needing to decrease the emissions that they produce. And so for us, we saw building that into industry strategic plan and building that into our investment framework for the next 5 years to make sure that if there is any regulatory interest in this area, that they have the full understanding of what a beef business looks like. You know, these aren't just cows in a paddock with emissions coming out the rear end. These aren't just trucks on the road with emissions coming out the rear tailpipe. These are landscape level businesses. And so we felt that was a real strategic priority and MLA was receptive to that. So what we're doing now in Australia, which probably hasn't got the fanfare it deserves, is really some world leading research around landscape analysis of emissions and sequestration, and particularly around things like methane, around how that actually that sits within Australian production systems. So I think that's been a big gain for us. And part of that is making sure that we can do that research so that we can communicate with consumers and our supply chain and with governments around this is the stuff that you need to understand. It's not just a point in time analysis of this is what's coming out. It's a far broader perspective that they need to be taking in terms of considering regulatory decision making. And just on this, sorry, I know this can be boring. I really hope if you are listening, I really hope you're still here. For land development in regions of this country, we're already regulated on these things. So it's not, this isn't an existential threat. This is in existence. So one of the things that you'll be required to do for probably larger scale development is conduct assessments of what carbon you'll be releasing from the dry matter and from the woody matter that you'll be essentially clearing and burning. So you need to do an assessment with it using various different satellite tools that says from this activity, I'll be generating this many carbon emissions. And then you need to take mitigating steps to either reduce that risk or show how you're going to re-sequester carbon in somewhere else. So this is already in legislation today. It's not specifically relating to the beef industry, but we're very conscious that this is really where the global appetite sits currently. We need to be accounting for our emissions in a holistic fashion, and we need to be communicating it. I mean, the non-financial disclosure legislation that's come in last year and will be affecting some of the really big beef businesses this year requires them to publicly report on emissions. So we're seeing this happening already, and what we're very much focused on is ensuring that we have adequate research to be able to participate in these things appropriately. Because the challenge at the moment is the research has been led primarily from an environmental perspective and very much from an emissions perspective and not from a landscape level or from a beef business level. So we're trying to plug that gap as quickly as we can.
Must be a major focus. So I, in the last period of time, had the privilege of meeting quite a senior Australian politician, and Angus Australia, we obviously a fairly big organisation. Feel like we've got a lot to say about Angus Beef, and got a lot of good projects. I was stunned, Will, though, the conversation completely revolved around methane. So yes, it was great that they had an interest in methane, the recording work we're doing in the Angus reference cattle population. But I was taken back with the focus. It was almost the, if they were breeding cattle, it'd be almost a single trait selection. You know, it was all the other productivity work that we're doing seemed to pale in insignificance. So I imagine for a policy organisation such as yours, very hard to get past that, isn't it? It's front and centre for politicians, but for the community.
Yeah. It is, and it's a global force. And I think regardless of what any of us think individually about climate variability, climate change, or think about our contributions to it, that the challenge for us, and so there's probably two streams here. So one, the Australian government is looking at increased regulation in this area, and that follows a global focus around emissions and the need to bring down emissions. So we need to participate in those conversations to make sure any sorts of regulatory actions that are taken are reflective of what we're doing and aren't going to compromise the operations of farming businesses or cattle businesses specifically. But the challenge that we have as the beef industry is we may be very successful in making sure that the regulatory settings in Australia are reflective of the realities of what we do, but we export to more than 100 countries. So for us, it's the beef industry is in this really challenging position where almost to an extent, what happens here from a regulatory perspective is very important to the operations of our business. But how we align with the expectations of our overseas markets is really what's going to facilitate our trade. And that's the challenge that we're facing, is we may need to look at doing things that aren't the requirements of the Australian government in order to facilitate our trade. Now, we're not seeing a lot of this at the moment. I want to be clear, you know, that increasing sustainability reporting is something that is coming through our supply chains, but no, this isn't becoming a condition of trade as of yet. There are conversations about it, and certainly from a European perspective, there's been conversations about a border adjustment mechanism around carbon emissions, but that still seems some way off. But I think where we need to be looking as an industry when we look forward is we need to have things that underpin our negotiations in this space, which is our research and our development and our science. And we need to always be pushing our brands as far as we can to make sure that they're underpinned by that science as well. So that element there that's missing at the moment or isn't as, I guess, well-established as it could be, is that we need really good science around what it is that we're contributing to these things. Because like you said, we do. We've got people who talk about methane and cows, and in their head, those two things are inextricably linked. They're only bad, and therefore we need to do something about them. And it's not. We're not doing well enough communicating the broader narrative.
Yeah. Okay. Well, just to slot one back in terms of the membership focus, it can be fairly unfairly seen as a northern industry body. Mm. That's not really the case, is it, Will? Do you want to give us a bit of an overview of how you are distributed? We've got a lot of southern members, so it's worth just posing the question.
No, yeah. So I think from a numbers perspective, we're pretty well evenly distributed. You know, we've certainly got strong southern membership, but where we can get that criticism comes down to largely that there's a lot of northern businesses that are just cattle producers. You know, so there's there is a lot of engagement from the north on these issues because for them, it's not a diversified business. This is what they've got. And so they can be very active in this space. And then obviously in the south, you know, you do have a large number of specialized beef businesses, don't get me wrong, but you do see those increasing diversification and you see people participating in a lot of other things. And I think that the challenge for southern guys in particular, you know, we've all got a finite amount of time, right? And if you're paying levies to grains plus lamb plus cattle plus, you know, a variety of other enterprises that you may have on your business, you've got cotton, you've got whatever, you know, where I compete with other organizations is to try and capture your attention for as long as I can to try and explain what are really complex and technical issues. So one of the challenges that we have is, you know, the way in which the South has so many demands on their time and the way in which people are, there's so many different entities who are competing for their attention. It can be difficult to get as much engagement opportunity as we would like. And one of the ways that we're looking at really trying to expand our engagement opportunity is through breed societies, because you guys have done an absolutely brilliant job in building those networks in the regions and building, you know, a lot of time into people's calendars to discuss things specifically about their cattle. So for us, we see breed societies and organisations like Angus Australia has been critical for us on how we can get to beef producers on the ground.
No, interesting. I imagine there's a challenge like it is for us to be able to reach different producers in different contexts and different production systems. I don't think it always works, and we're always at a board level. We're always talking about how do we get that engagement. And you're correct in saying it's a very busy space now with information with our memberships. Hence, one of the reasons for our podcast is to try and be able to get some cut through in a format that where people can listen, I guess, more easily. And so that's a good overview of that membership. What sort of staffing size do you have, Will? Like, how do you operate there?
Well, so we've got 10 staff at the moment, and we're sort of split into two key functions. So one function of the business, and obviously for most people listening, the most important side of the business from an industry perspective is our policy and advocacy arm. We've got some really talented people working in that space and really specialised people working in that space. And their attention is really on the day-to-day operations and interactions that we have around policy and around delivering those strategic imperatives that we're given by our regional members and by, obviously, the Cattle Australia Board. The other arm to our business is our engagement arm. And it's an arm that we're building, we're increasingly building. We have a Northern Engagement Officer and a Southern Engagement Officer at the moment. And if you're listening to this podcast, I've got no doubt that you will be running into certainly, well, at a minimum, our Southern Engagement Officer or Extension Officer at the moment. We're putting in a huge effort to get out there and really see people. So if you do see someone with a Cattle Australia shirt on, go up and grab them and have a yarn to them, because we're putting a lot of time and energy and investment into making sure that we're as visible as possible. We do tend to target things like bull sales, things like breed society events, show circuits, those sorts of things, to really try to capture as many people as possible. But that side of our business is a side of business that we've got a lot of attention on at the moment, and we're really looking to expand and trying to get as many boots out on the ground as possible, so that, you know, it goes back to what you're talking about. You know, once someone's back at home, that they're in the workplace, right? Like there's a lot of things to focus on and a lot of immediate pressing tasks that people have got to get to. So, you know, sending out a 30-page email and saying, what are your thoughts around this, is probably not the most effective way, right? So for us, it's about having people with boots on the ground at events that people have come to and they're spending the day at already, and having that interaction with them to say, look, this is a 30-page document. Don't worry about reading it. Here's the six things in there that are really important. What do you think about those things? And really trying to get that feedback through. So the engagement side of our business is really what informs a lot of what we do from a policy perspective, and really make sure that our touch points in the regions are keeping us up to date of what are the issues that are emerging.
Pleased to report, Will, that recently at the Southern Beef Week's open days, I did bump into Sam quite frequently. He was often driving up the same driveway that I was, so he's doing a great job handling the flesh.
He's an incredibly busy man. That, like, I don't know, he's managed to squeeze 26 hours into a 24-hour day. No, he's a huge asset for us in the South. He's doing a really great job.
Yeah, he's got a great engagement with our members, and it was a pleasure to saw him on more than quite a few occasions and quite a few days in a row. So no, he's doing it. That's your report back. He's doing quite well in the South. That's great. Oh,
I don't know if you'll listen to this, but I might mention it to him in next week's staff meeting. But don't want him to get too excited.
Will, our roles are similar, and I guess there's a fair few overlapping priorities we end up with in these types of roles. You can end up with you'll have your strategic plan with Cattle Australia. You've got the busyness which goes with that. But if you like, mate, you're trying to condense it down into some priorities that you would like to achieve for the organisation as a CEO. What if you have your five-year plan going forward, and when you start these roles, you think we're a little bit more ambitious than is practical. What do you got on the whiteboard there behind you? So, Will, what are those big gold nuggets that you're trying to achieve?
Look, the biggest thing, the thing that will, for better or for worse, be very present for the beef industry this year is we've called a review of the cattle transaction levy. So under the legislation, and under the way our industry governing documents work, we're the only entity that can do that. We've made that call last year that it needed to happen. And where we're up to at the moment is we've built the unattractive sort of mechanism or all the mechanics, like we've got the terms of references and all those things sorted. And where we are now is we have pulled the trigger on really beginning this process. And, the levy review is critical for a lot of different reasons. And I know there's a lot of people out there who probably pay a lot of different levies and will be going, just leave me alone. The challenge that we have and why it's become such a pressing issue is that we haven't amended it in any way, shape or form in 20 years. And some of the recipient bodies within the levy structure currently, we actually haven't amended anything to do with what funds they receive since 1998. So the challenge that we have is the industry has changed significantly since that time, and the requirements that we place on some of these institutions has changed significantly. And we need to have a conversation about what is it that we need from these guys and what does that mean for us in the future, and how do we resource them? But what I do want to also say, I think everyone automatically assumes when I talk that way that we're saying, oh, well, the levy's $5 and it's going to go to X. That's not what we're saying. The reality is that the priority area for us to start this process with is communicating and really understanding is that there's value we're not capturing now. So within the $5 of the money that we're receiving today, or the industry is receiving today, we're missing some opportunities in there. And so the focus for us at the beginning of this review process is question number one is where are we today and what do we need for the future? And question number two is, how much of the lost value of what we have currently can meet that need? And I think that's the approach that we're taking. Now, we're going to come out, we'll be doing a lot of consultation with the industry in this year. We want to hear what everyone has to say. And we're going to come out to everybody with some information around this is what we're seeing and this is where we see the opportunities. And if everyone says we want the levy to go to whatever number it is, then that's the consultation that we'll receive. But the reality for us, the starting point, is communicating what the status quo is today, really where we see that there's existing value within, and this is many millions of dollars of existing value, where we see that existing value being lost, and then what steps can we take to capture that? So one of the things that we're looking at is increase in flexibility around how the quantums within the levy are adjusted and what we can do, how can we make that process simpler? So as an example, you know, the National Residue Survey does basically all of our residue testing that enables our market access, enables our domestic market access. The playing field has shifted quite a lot. Like from, like I mentioned earlier, from 2009, we had one free trade agreement. Today we've got, you know, more than 10. So the requirements that have been placed on the NRS over time have increased substantially. And one of the challenges that we have currently is if we want to go to the NRS and say, you guys need a bit more money to be able to do this a bit more effectively, we have to go through a process like this to be able to do that. So it's very rigid. The structures are very defined, and the processes that you go through to try and make amendments are really tricky. So one of the questions we want to ask people and talk to people about is, you know, do we need greater flexibility to make those changes? When LSD and FMD was identified in Indonesia, what the industry asked Animal Health Australia to do was a significant increase in their workload. And one of the things that, I guess, slowed down the ability to do so much of that work was we had to go find funding for it, or the government had to provide funding for it, or we were relying on, because what we weren't able to do was say, well, within the levy that we've got, maybe they need a little bit more money for the next 2 or 3 years to be able to do these things. So some of the questions that we'll be asking people is around, look, do you want this to be a more flexible structure? Do you want us to be able to make adjustments more often? We're based on the needs of the industry. And within the existing $5, do you want to see that become a little bit more easy to manage? So, you know, I'm optimistic we're not going to spook anybody too early in this process. We really want to come out and say, look, this is the state of play. This is what the current requirements are. This is what we're seeing into the future. What do you guys think? And we're building a system around that. We've obviously just appointed an independent committee to oversight this process. That committee's makeup is two producers from the north, two producers from the south, one producer from the west, and then two technical experts. And those are the guys who will be looking to really give us that guidance on what we need to be prioritizing in this process. And then the guidance on, you know, what questions do we need to be asking the industry to really help make an informed decision. But I think the key message for anyone listening is, you know, we're approaching this from a cattle producer perspective. My board is made up of cattle producers. And we're very conscious about we need to be prioritising this in the right way.
Pretty big project, and it sounds good. Actually, it sounds a good one. A lot of our listeners would be interested. What else is on that whiteboard, Will, that you're trying to punch out?
Yeah, I mean, there's the issues-based stuff, and then there's the strategic things, right? So trade is increasingly becoming an issues-rich environment. What we've seen with China, what we've seen with Indonesia, what we're seeing now with the Middle East, realistically, these are things that have bearing on farm gate profitability. You know, we're very conscious of needing to find resolution pathways for some of these things. Obviously, as the beef industry, you know, pulling up the conflict in the Middle East is probably not something we're going to be able to achieve by ourselves. But the strategic side of that is we have learned the lesson time and time and time again that diversification of our trade markets is one of the most important things for us as an industry to be able to survive and prosper through periods like this. And so the government's been very receptive to that. They've announced some funding for increasing trade diversification. You know, I guess research and looking at new opportunities and trying to make sure that we have as many pathways available to us as possible. Because and strategically, I think the industry's been looking in this direction for a long time. It's one of the reasons why we have the amount of trade agreements we do. But, you know, we are seeing changes in trade globally. So for us, the big questions are how do we position ourselves in this? And how do we make sure, you know, and there's sort of two aspects to it currently. I mean, one of the great outcomes of the last sort of decade is that we do have terrific market access. But one of the challenges we have when we have conflicts like we've got at the moment is our vehicle to actually get it there, which is essentially ships, can become hugely challenging for the industry. So we've also got to make sure we've got a robust domestic market. We have pathways to be able to store product if we need to. So we're really trying to take that holistic view around what does trade diversification and resilience look like? And that's a big area of focus for us at the moment. Look, to be honest, there's always a laundry list of things that are on board. But the things that I think the things that people will find most interesting are often to do with trade. And so for us, it's we support the work of the processors and the government in this space. You know, we're not the only players here, but making sure that everyone's attention is pointing in the same direction around being able to ensure that we have viable trade routes is really important.
Yeah, okay. A good jumping off point is that government relationship there. Will, we've had on the podcast Tony Kerr, the Queensland Primary Industries Minister, great guy and a great, he's well known to a lot of beef producers and he has good connections through industry and I guess a very positive fellow to work with from a state base. How's your relationship with the feds? And, you know, to ask the awkward question, Labor government, traditionally not well represented in regional heartland, how do you go with the Federal Minister Julie Collins, and is it easy to establish those relationships when it's not necessarily the fundamental front and center client base? How do you go navigating that, Will?
It's a really interesting question, and look, we've got a good relationship with the minister. And you know, ag. I mean, I look at it. You know, being the agriculture minister for Australia has got to be one of the harder jobs going, right? Like, regardless of what party you're from. And the word agriculture is kind of stupid, to be honest, because the difference between a Northern Territory cattle producer and, just within the cattle industry. So the difference between a Northern Territory cattle producer and, say, a Victorian cattle producer couldn't be more profound from a regulatory perspective. They've got different forms of land tenure. They've got different environments requirements, different requirements for water. They've got different, certainly different workforce requirements. They've got completely different transport and freight. They've got completely different market opportunities. So the common factor is they both have cattle, but realistically, from a business perspective, they couldn't be more different from each other. So that's a real challenge. And when you're the agriculture minister, you know, you're not just cattle, you're everything else as well. And we are a sector that has a massive amount of challenges and issues. We export, you know, hundreds of products all around the world. It's a really complicated industry to be a minister for. What I can say about Minister Collins is look, she's really approached it from a learning perspective, and she's come in and I think she's really, I think she's picked up a lot, to be honest. And, you know, it is challenging for people from a Labor background where you may not come through agriculture to be put into these sorts of roles. I think she's doing a really terrific job getting across it. The challenge with working with Labor governments, and I've done a lot of it in the Territory and a lot of it in Canberra, it's not that they don't have a fondness or a keenness for agriculture, it's that they have competing priorities. You know, so when we have a Conservative government, agriculture is a bit higher up the list for funding, resourcing, for support. But with Labor, they have priorities that are different. So that I don't think they actively seek to harm the agricultural sector necessarily. I think it's more that they have other priorities that they focus on. So for us, and you know, for the minister, it's a challenge for her. And for us, the challenge is how do we elevate our issues up? And we've seen with this government, there has been times where agriculture has been elevated front and center. Certainly the biosecurity funding that was announced following the LSD and FMDR breaks, you know, that was something that was a key government decision. And that was made by Cabinet and that was fully endorsed by the full federal government. So that was a very robust response. We put, you know, millions of vaccines into Indonesia. We significantly resourced the northern production systems and the northern, I guess, institutions around being able to do more work in this area. So that was very welcomed. And then what we're seeing with trade at the moment, Minister Farrell has very clearly said, you know, the sticking points that remain in the EU-FTA negotiations are beef and lamb. And from his perspective, he needs to get a good deal. You know, and beef and lamb were the negotiations in Osaka a couple of years ago with the EU guys was why he walked away from the table. So I think that it's not necessarily that, you know, a Labor government isn't friendly towards agriculture, but what is a real challenge is elevating our issues to a level where we get a really broad focus on what we're doing. And we do see occasions where that happens at the moment.
That's good. And it seems like you've got a good handle on that relationship, which is really positive for agriculture. It can't be easy for the minister either in a cabinet that sometimes got those competing priorities.
Well, I think that's right. And I feel like banning the word agriculture sometimes. Like it's such a big industry and it's so diverse. Like the Minister for Resources, in some respects, is actually easier because what we're extracting by and large is relatively consistent. But agriculture is a bit of a nightmare. I mean, you're talking about hundreds and hundreds of products produced by businesses that are incredibly different to each other. So how you sort of engage with it at a federal level is incredibly challenging.
Interesting. Well, we might just change tack and talk to you personally. How do you keep yourself sharp, Will, in terms of are you a reader or do you you're very busy workload in your role? Yeah, what do you do to sharpen yourself, and have you got any good resources you might want some of our listeners towards?
Yeah, I mean, look, it probably changes from time to time. I mean, I am a big reader, and I do inevitably fall down that pathway of a lot of the things that I read. This sounds negative. It's almost the reality TV version of books. Like, I do a lot of detective novels and things like that you buy an airport because they're right there, and they're just a good sort of, you can sit on a plane and conk out for a couple of hours. But I think in terms of podcasts, there's a couple I'd point people to, like, because podcasts work really well in our industry because everyone spends so long in a car with no phone reception.
Yeah.
So podcasts for me have been, like, terrific. Like, I've been a long time listener of Dan Carlin's Hardcore Histories, and anyone who loves a bit of a history podcast, he does this 7-hour podcast that, I used to put on in Darwin and would still be going by the time I got to Alice. So they're one I really recommend if you've got a bit of a history interest and, you're looking into a big journey in the car. I couldn't recommend it more highly. I mean, in terms of stuff I do to keep balance, I mean, I think that's an answer that changes all the time. I just bought a house in Toowoomba. It's an old house. And, when you go there for the sort of open home and they're trying to sell it, you think, oh, yeah, I'm going to knock that wall down and I'm going to paint these things and I can't wait to get into all these renovations. And then after a week of owning it, you're going, geez, I can't wait to get a bloke in to do all these renovations. So my wife's doing a lot of project management really at the moment, which is good, which is great because it is really rewarding. But when I'm not working, let's be honest, I'm normally in the garden or I'm pottering around the house trying to fix gutters or something like that. And for me, I find that really cathartic.
No, that's interesting. We won't, if you want a quick word to Will, you'll find him at Bunnings on a Sunday morning in Toowoomba.
Mate, I'll tell you what, after living in the territory for 8 years and, during the dry season, your reliance on your irrigation system is pretty substantial, when you don't have rain for 6-7 months of the year. If anyone needs any tips on, your pop-up sprinkler systems, and you see me in Bunnings, I think I'm a black belt at this point in time. I know pretty well everything about the things, but that's for your members probably that's helpful. Yeah, yeah. I can do a sort of a 10-square-meter lawn, but they're dealing with lawns that are a lot bigger than that.
That's great. Well, if you're talking to a young person starting out in business or ag policy or agricultural organisations, What advice would you give them?
Oh, I mean, there's one that I probably learned the hard way or learned a bit too late in life. It's, do a lot more listening than you do talking is always a really good one. And I think, one of the things, ag has got so much interest these days from a lot of kids, especially young ones who don't come from the industry. And so I do spend a fair bit of time talking to them. And there's probably two things I think that are really important. And one is... ask questions, because one of the amazing things about our industry in particular is how generous people are with their time and how generous people are, especially with young people, and how generous people are in teaching and passing on knowledge. And, you can learn more in an afternoon sitting at the right pub in this country, with the right people and just asking the right questions than you can in, 6 months of gap, really. You can really get absolutely critical knowledge by just spending a bit of time and investing a bit of time in sitting with people and asking them questions. And for me, so much of what I've learned about the industry, it's not written down in a textbook. There's nowhere to learn it except by sitting with people and really spending a lot of time with them and asking questions. So you use the resources around you, become a part of your industry groups, you become a part of your breed societies, and understand that it's a lifetime's commitment. Like, you're not going to learn what everyone else knows in 12 months or 2 years or 3 years. The only way to learn it is you've got to say, well, I'm going to be here for the next 25 years and this is what I'm really going to focus on trying to learn. And, if you're lucky, at the end of that 25 years, you might know half as much as everyone else does.
That's very good. Now, well, a question I do want to ask, because we don't get many Territorians on the shows. Any great characters you've met in your time? Mentioning any of those?
Yeah, I mean, I've met some really amazing people. You know, anyone who's willing to be a stocky on live export vessels as a profession has got a pretty unique character. And there's one of them that's actually speaking at the NTCA conference, or speaking at the one of the events in a couple of weeks. And you meet some amazing people. Some of the guys I've met who spent a lot of time in Southeast Asia, really building the feedlot sector over there, are some of the most fascinating people I've met. And I think that one of the things that we're seeing a bit of a gap in at the moment is a lot of young people who are looking at heading in that direction. And mm-hmm. you know, that taking the step of moving into Southeast Asia and living there permanently and really making a commitment to that, to try and build a business or to work in a business. There's still huge opportunity in that space, but we just don't have a lot of people who are willing to take that jump. So, you know, a lot of the amazing people I've met happen, like guys like, you know, Dr. Ross Ainsworth, Greg Pankhurst, Dick Slaney. You know, a lot of these guys have been critical to the prosperity of the northern cattle industry and can go a little bit unnoticed because they've spent most of their career in Indonesia and Southeast Asia and really dedicating a lot of their time over there. So, you know, some of those guys, if you ever run into them at the pub, get a few beers in them and just the stories they've got are just astonishing. And like there are still guys getting around in our industry. And this sort of stuff happened years and years ago where, you know, you would have a ship with cattle on it and you'd pull up to an island in Asia and it didn't have an unloading facility. Like it doesn't have a port. So you'd jump cattle off the side and you'd swim and you'd jump in with the cattle and you'd swim in with them, you know. And there are still guys who I mean, they're getting on a bit now, but there are still guys who were those guys who jumped in the water. You know, there's some amazing stories about our industry if you go find them. And often pubs in Darwin or in Charters Towers or in Mount Isa or, you know, in Wagga, or they can be some of the best places to go find, you know, some people who've lived some really interesting experiences.
That's great, Will. I would underline it for young people. My first job out of college was in Southeast Asia and in Singapore and in selling beef and lamb and other products, and worked for a Chinese company. I actually need to qualify that these days, a Singaporean company run by Chinese people. And it was a great learning experience for me and learned a lot of skills. And yeah, if a young person listening to this, you could do a lot worse than to get a job in Southeast Asia. There's still a lot of opportunity there.
It's a fascinating part of the world to live in. It can be hard, but it's amazing.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Nearly at the end, you've got the Angus community. Is there anything, Will, do you think we've missed that you'd like to mention to some of our Angus breeders, commercial seed stock this morning that, yeah, or you might have looked across the fence and gone, do you Angus bucks need to improve a few things there? I'd like to make any sort of comments before we start to finish up, Will.
I think the only thing I'd say, I mean, Angus has got such an enormous tailwind globally. You know, it's really well positioned. But I think the only thing I'd say to the Angus guys, and it's really a compliment on what I see in a lot of the businesses out there, is their keenness to move forward and their keenness to embrace innovation. And I think looking to that younger generation and really trying to build those guys into the business. And one of the great frontiers for all businesses at the moment, but for the big question for cattle, is how are things like AI going to change the game, and how is that finally using the, you know, 50 years of data records that we've managed to generate across so much of our industry? What are we going to do with all that information? And so, like, for me, I'm very much paying attention to organizations like Angus Australia in terms of, you know, how are we going to harness these opportunities? And what it's going to come down to, I think, in a lot of cases, is we're going to have to get the young kids in to teach us what to do. You know, I don't know how to code. I've got absolutely, I can spell code. I mean, I can write you a great letter about the importance of understanding coding, but I wouldn't be able to even type the first line of it. You know, and kids are learning this at high school. You know, so I think the only thing I'd say for the Angus guys is, you know, keep going. But for me, I'm really looking to you guys around innovation and around technology, and really looking to you guys and really keen to watch how you start incorporating these things into your breed societies, but through your genetic systems and really, really refining what it is that you guys have spent so long building. Because like the state of the Australian breeding community, I think, is incredibly strong. You know, I was talking to somebody recently. It was a guy who's an exporter who used to go over the States and buy a lot of genetics out of the States, out of Canada and that kind of thing. I said, oh, look, do you still do that now? And he said, oh, I still go over. I probably spend a lot more time looking than I do buying. You know, and that's an amazing reflection on the Australian cattle industry at the moment, where, you know, we are at the forefront of so much of this stuff globally. And we're at the forefront of a lot of the breeds globally. And I guess the challenge for us is realizing that we are, and then the opportunity is, well, deciding what happens next, because so much of what happens in the global beef industry in the next 20 years is going to be decided here. Obviously, Brazil is a huge beast as well, don't get me wrong, and so much of what they do, I think, is absolutely fascinating from a feedlotting perspective, and the way that they're able to produce cattle the way they do. But from that technical side of things, I mean, we are right at the forefront of so much of this. And for us, it's really harnessing that opportunity and really continuing to lead the global industry in the right direction.
Mm, that's some good points, Will. And actually, in more recent times, I had a very big Australian feedstock producer tell me that for the first time, they didn't need to bring in any American genetics or North American genetics. They could find all the genetic progression they needed in Australia, and it's a great testament one to the breeders here, but I think to the Australian industry, I think it's across the whole spectrum of advancement. I think it's been very positive. The last 20 years has transformed the industry, and I think particularly it's moving very fast now. And there's some good comments.
It's going to be frustrating when we see 22-year-old kids running companies that are incredibly important to the prosperity of our business. But I've got no doubt in the next 5 years there's going to be a few of them pop up and they're able to do things that none of us have got any. I can't even update the software on my computer. So, we're going to need some of those nerds.
I think one of the great things about our industry, Will, is people used to talk about, when we were at Gatton and things, they'd talk about, and then over the years people would talk about the aging population in the beef industry. And it's nearly irrelevant now. You get so many good young people in the industry. I think it's fantastic. And our breed's the same as the water industry. We're just attracting a lot of young, sharp minds to the industry. I think it's very positive.
Well, and I think on that, I mean, I think you're right. I think we're seeing more of that. I mean, I had a meeting sort of towards the end of last year with some researchers, and these are researchers of this institution have been working on a really important animal welfare research project for maybe 10 years. And it's incredibly complex. They've had a lot of people sort of put their minds to this, and it's this really difficult metric that we're trying to develop. And we've had this massive breakthrough with it that, you know, in the coming years will likely appear in our industry. But the breakthrough came because they went and got a guy who's got a PhD in basically statistical analysis. So this guy works in theoretical physics and all those sorts of kind of things that I don't understand. And they brought him in and they said, look, this is where we're up to. We've got hundreds of different indicators with thousands of different variables. Like, what do we do? And for him, that was quite simple, you know. But for us, coming from an animal welfare perspective, it was just a little bit beyond our grasp. And they brought this guy, he's only a young bloke, and they brought him in, and he's building this incredible model. But it's a skill set that we never would have looked to 10 years ago, right? Like, obviously statistical analysis is something that not 90% of scientists do, but we never would have thought of going and getting a guy from the physics department, bringing him into the animal welfare department, saying, can you help us fix this? But we are increasingly, our industry, as we get more sophisticated, we're looking to those sorts of skill sets to give us those next big steps forward.
It's brilliant. Will, the final question for the day, what's your the best beef eating experience that you've ever had? You get some great answers to this. So
yeah,
as CEO of Cattle Australia, should have a good one, Will.
It's one of those ones that's potentially career ending for me. So it's a really complicated answer. Look, I think I'm going to give probably a really shitty answer to this question, to be honest. But, you know, for me, one of the things that my enduring legacy of beef when I was a kid was, you know, dad at the Rural Fire Brigade barbecue kind of thing. And Those boys, you know, especially back then, they deserve an awful lot of credit for all of the services they provided the community and still provide the community. But they probably have made the largest and most, you know, resounding impact on how not to cook steak of any section of our community. Like, I mean, it was grey, it was tough, it was horrific. But for me, you know, as a kid, when you'd go to those barbecues and you'd get that burger that was like way too big to be able to fit in your mouth, and you've got your pineapple and your beetroot and your lettuce and your tomato, and then this horrifically overcooked stringy steak with covered in barbecue sauce. Yeah, for me, I look back on that and think, geez, haven't we come a long way as an industry where you can now eat a steak without a set of pliers? But that's probably the most sort of nostalgic, you know, beef eating
That's
experience.
great. That's great. Well, you've not gone where I thought you would, Will, and that is great. That's fantastic. Some of our American listeners that sneak in might be wondering, what do you put on a steak sandwich in Australia? But that's fantastic.
And that's an extension opportunity for the Americans. If you don't have tinned beetroot and tinned pineapple on your steak sandwich, you are missing out.
That's it. I'm sure that the American CEO will be listening to this, and they'll be preparing for the next World Angus Forum in the US, and they'll be importing beetroot. Will?
We'll send over a couple of hundred teams and they could have a crack. But yeah, no, I think that's the amazing thing about steak today. You go into Coles and Woolies, I think in so many ways we undervalue it, right? Like the quality of what we produce and the way it's changed in the last 10 years, 15 years. The reality is every single Australian can now go into a supermarket 10, well, you know, the guys in the cities 10 minutes away from their house and buy a steak that if you put it on any restaurant menu, pretty well anywhere overseas, no one will complain about it. You know, like the quality of the produce that we are able to give to Australians every single day is far and beyond what you'd get anywhere else in the world. It's just astonishing. And a lot of credit needs to go to the Angus guys for being a part of that.
No, you're right. Well, I think we're blessed with some fantastic product in a range of outlets, and it had different price points too. I think it's not all high end. We're fortunate to have beef at a range of price points too for the consumer, and quality has come a long way. When I was younger, it was tough to get a good steak, and now we get too many good steaks. So.
We suffer from the luxury of choice is one of the biggest challenges. Like, you know, what are you going to pick? Are you going to get this one? Are you going to get this one? You've got grain fed, you've got grass fed, you've got incredible choices, and right on the touch of your fingers. I think that's, you know, a lot of credit. It speaks to just how far the industry's come.
No, that's great. Well, look, fantastic. We've gone over time. We really appreciate you taking time out of your very busy schedule to talk to the Angus members this morning. If anyone listening, Will is very approachable, and we've got a great leader in CEO, Will Evans, heading up Cattle Australia. It's great that you're in the position, and I'd encourage anyone to come and have a yarn when they see you at one of the industry functions. And we really appreciate the work you're doing and appreciate your time today, Will.
No, thanks, mate. I really appreciate it. And yeah, your members are the guys doing the heavy lifting out there. So, you know, good luck to them. And I hope the season goes well.
Thanks, Phil.
Thanks for joining us today. We hope you enjoyed this episode of The Angus Table. We look forward to bringing you more conversations that support your success in the Angus breed and your farming operation. I'm Scott Wright, CEO of Angus Australia, and today's Angus Table podcast is produced by Mel Strasberg. Until next time, all the best.